Good evening. Is Trump about to blink in the fight over funding the Postal Service? Is the president suffering from mental health problems? And can fascism happen here? We talk with a historian. With these and other stories, I'm Paul D'Arienzo with the WBAI News for Friday, August 14th, 2020. Joe Biden gained the presidential endorsement of the National Association of Letter Carriers on Friday, a union that boasts nearly 300,000 active and retired postal workers. The endorsement comes less than 3 months before Election Day and a day after Trump said he opposes Postal Service funding pushed by Democrats. Trump says funds for the post office will allow mail-in voting. Trump opposes mail-in voting because he says without evidence the practice allows for fraud. Congressional Democrats, backed by Biden, have sought $3.6 billion to help equip states for an expected surge in mail-in votes, as well as $25 billion to shore up the Postal Service. But today, under questioning at the White House, Trump seemed to step back from his demands.
More money for the U.S. Postal Service and mail-in balloting. Yeah. If the Democrats were to give you some of what you want, which you articulated in a series of tweets in the last hour, would you be willing to accept the $25 billion for the Postal Service, including the $3.5 billion to
handle mail-in voting? Sure, they give us what we want. And it's not what I want. It's what the American people want. So in addition to, and I think, John, as part of your answer, I can read this, but in addition to the executive orders that we signed, which are going to be doing terrific things in terms of payroll tax cut, which is a lot of money coming to a lot of people very quickly. I've directed the Secretary of the Treasury to get ready and send direct payments, $3,400 for a family of four to all Americans. Democrats are holding this up. I am ready to have the UST and SBA send additional PPP payments to small businesses that have been hurt by the China virus. Democrats are holding this up. So we're talking about those are two things directly involved and really victim of the China virus. We're ready to send. Democrats are holding up. I'm ready to send rental assistance payments to hardworking Americans that have been hurt by the China virus. All of these things are in a list. Democrats are holding this up. I'm ready to send $105 billion to the states to help open schools safely with additional PPE. And Democrats are holding this up. So that's $105 billion to the states to help open schools safely with additional PPE. Democrats are holding that up, right? And I'm ready to send more money to states and local governments to save jobs of our great police, our firefighters, our first responders and teachers. It's all ready to go. Democrats are holding it up. So they're holding, John, all of that up.
So if they were to give you that, you would sign off on the money for the Postal Service?
Yeah, but they're not giving it to me. They're giving it to the American people. I mean,
agree to that?
Yeah, I would certainly do that, sure. I would do that.
Yeah. Yeah. I just want to follow up.
And that's President Trump. The recently appointed Postmaster General, Louis DeJoy, is a major donor and ally of the president. He's leading a cost-cutting effort, what he calls a reorganization of the institution that has been blamed for delays in mail delivery. The White House Postal Task Force has recommended revoking collective bargaining rights for postal unions, massive cuts to services, and potential privatization of the agency. And President Trump said on Friday he's planning to visit his younger brother, Robert Trump, who's hospitalized in New York. The president said today his brother is seriously ill. Earlier this summer, Robert Trump failed to block publication of his niece Mary Trump's best-selling tell-all book, Too Much and Never Enough, about their family. Trump's niece describes a family riven by a series of traumas made worse by his father, Fred, who, quote, destroyed Donald Trump by short-circuiting his ability to develop and experience the entire spectrum of human emotion. Forensic psychiatrist Mandy Lee is editor of the New York Times bestseller, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump. 27 psychiatrists and mental health professionals assess the president. She also interviewed Mary Trump, who's also a mental health professional. She says both came to similar conclusions about the president's mental problems.
You can see that we both agree that the public has been greatly deprived of expertise, and this has prevented the public from being able to distinguish what is pathological from what is normal variation and therefore healthy and life-affirming. And therefore, the public does need to hear about. I don't think it's too late. I believe that if the public can inform itself and have the benefit of not only facts, but expertise, which is the best available knowledge that we have, then it can make informed choices and protect its safety and well-being.
Isn't a lot of the way that Trump is acting sort of necessary personality for doing what he's doing? I mean, his voters voted for him to do certain things, and you would have to have his personality to do those things.
Yes, there are many variations of personality that are within the normal range, within the healthy human range. And then there are abnormal signs of the person going outside of normal and outside of healthy. And that goes into the pathological realm, which the public would not be well positioned or trained to be able to recognize. So it would be the responsibility of professionals to point that out. And it's actually not anything esoteric. There are standards and guidelines, and if we follow those standards, then we can detect signs of pathology. We can argue it in court. The results should be consistent across the board if we apply professional standards. And so what happens when this is allowed to go on without making that distinction? Then pathology can take over society. And we have seen that in other countries. It has always not ended well, in fact, ended in catastrophe. And people can just follow along with it and believe that it is good for the good of their country or the good of their society when it is not, because they are taken in by the pathology. Mental pathology, by definition, is that it takes over your mind so that you cannot make informed, rational decisions that are to your own interest.
Yeah, and what are some of the things that were in that book and from your discussions with Trump's niece that were interesting to you that stuck out?
In our discussion, we spoke about how the president pointed out the problems with Mary Trump and her father, Fred Jr. There wasn't anything wrong per se with them. They weren't, quote unquote, a mess, but rather it was problems within Donald Trump and the father, Fred Sr., whereby their emotional and psychological problems created a situation where healthy individuals would not be able to cope and would not even be able to survive in her father's case. So we spoke about that and how it took distance and training on her part to be able to tell apart what was the real destructive force in her family by studying family systems, psychological principles, and the difference between health and pathology, which leads to damage and death.
In people's normal lives, how do they run into these problems?
The problem of mental pathology is that the more you need help, the less you're likely to seek it on your own. It's best to try to seek help before things get so bad. In other words, when things start to feel overwhelming or distressing, because mental pathology also brings about mental suffering. It also brings about poor insight, which means that you'll blame the suffering on somebody else. When the suffering begins and when there is distress, it's good to seek out help right away. And because it's the healthier people who seek out health on their own, people who voluntarily would come to my office or any therapist's office tend to be people who don't need as much help, but that can prevent things worsening. The usual is that many people get in trouble, they're either arrested or their family members cannot take it anymore and they are forced to come to therapy either by family members threatening a divorce or stating that they just have to. That's often how we come to see them when problems are serious.
And last point, Kanye West, who, as we're told, has mental problems. Is he being used and being taken advantage of by his friends in order to run for president?
You become more vulnerable to manipulation by others, and it's a weakening of the mental state. No matter how much you try to project strength, it's usually false strength because you're inflating your image or wishing to appear that you have things together. Those are people who need help. They're not to be exploited, but they are eminently, of course, exploitable. That's one of the reasons why many people have said Mr. Trump and the office of the presidency is so dangerous, because he is so manipulable by hostile forces, hostile foreign powers, or authoritarian elements within Congress even, that people with special interests who would not be able to get their interests through with a healthy president are able to get their agendas passed.
Trump is being used.
I think that's quite obvious.
Anything like that?
Not to shun expertise. Expertise is helpful, and it's meant to help the public. There are best practices that can reduce the suffering and save lives.
And that's forensic psychiatrist Bandy Lee. You can read her interview with Mary Trump at BandyLee.com. The Justice Department announced today the seizure of Iranian petroleum bound for Venezuela aboard four tankers near the Straits of Hormuz. The move was said to enforce a forfeiture order aimed at both Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps and the Caracas government. More than 1 million barrels of petroleum were confiscated. The cargo was intercepted on Wednesday, acting on a warrant issued by a U.S. district court over a July 2nd complaint seeking the forfeiture of all petroleum products aboard the vessels. The property is now in U.S. custody. In a tweet, Iran's ambassador to Venezuela rejected as fake news the U.S. claim of seizing the four tankers, calling the report yet another lie and psychological warfare by the U.S. propaganda machine, and denying ownership of the oil shipment. And Trump on Thursday gave credence to a false and racist conspiracy theory about Kamala Harris' eligibility to be vice president. Trump told reporters he had heard rumors that Harris, a black woman and U.S.-born citizen whose parents were immigrants, does not meet the requirement to serve in the White House. Harris was born in Oakland, California, and is eligible for both the vice presidency and presidency under the constitutional requirements. It's not the first time the illegitimacy smear has been used by Trump. He was a high-profile force behind the so-called birther movement, the lie that questioned whether President Barack Obama, the nation's first black president, was eligible to serve. And a three-judge panel of the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals on Friday threw out California's ban on high-capacity ammunition magazines, saying the law violates the U.S. Constitution's protection of the right to bear firearms. Gun owners cannot immediately rush to buy high-capacity magazines because the stay issued by the lower court judge remains in place. Governor Gavin Newsom, who championed the magazine ban when he was lieutenant governor, defended the law as a vital gun violence prevention measure. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul D'Arienzo. Is the notion true? The United States is facing a political crossroads this November because of the potential of the rise of some form of World War II-era fascism, the system of authoritarian and violent government introduced by Mussolini and Hitler in the first half of the 20th century. Or can it happen here? In an article posted on alternet.org titled How Donald Trump Has Constructed a Legal Infrastructure of Fascism, lawyer and retired judge Bill Blum says maybe it can.
The basic weaknesses that allow for minority rule start with the Electoral College, which allows a minority president to be elected. And in the case of Trump, he loses by 2.8 million votes and yet becomes president. And then there's the constitutional design of the Senate. The Senate controls presidential appointments, and each state's given two senators, regardless of their population size. So you can have a situation where the aggregate popular vote for the Senate weighs heavily in favor of the Democrats, and yet the Republicans control it. And if you have a Republican Party that is essentially a toadying organization to the president, then you also have minority rule. And then you have things like the president's power to issue executive orders and essentially rule by decree. You have the National Emergencies Act, which Trump invoked to shift money from one allocation to another to build his border wall. You have an immigration system, which historically, and in terms of the power of the president, has been used for racist purposes. You have the growth of the Department of Homeland Security as a police force that the president can deploy against peaceful protesters. You have the pardon power, which is virtually unlimited in the Constitution, and the president has abused it to reward his cronies and allies. And then you have the erosion of the Justice Department under its independence under Bill Barr, and you have voter suppression techniques that have been approved by the Supreme Court, including voter ID laws, voting roll purges, the closing of polling stations, the approval of gerrymandering, political gerrymandering, and, of course, now the attacks on the post office. So these are weaknesses, soft spots in American democracy that allowed someone who was hell-bent on eroding the norms, not the laws necessarily, but taking advantage of the laws and then eroding the norms, the way that the laws were previously respected, for the purpose of enhancing his own personal power and advancing an agenda that really isn't in the interest of the majority or and isn't supported by the majority.
What's at the root of these weaknesses?
At the inception of the birth of our republic, this republic was founded by wealthy white men of property who were elitists. Many of them owned slaves, and they were afraid of majority rule. Now, they constructed a very ingenious system of government marked by separation of powers between three branches of government. But at the same time, there were all of these mechanisms embedded in the Constitution which allowed for, in essence, a monarchical chief executive. And that's what we have today. And yes, there's a theory that empowers him called the unitary executive theory that Bill Barr is a primary proponent of, which basically is a theory of executive branch supremacy. And that's what we're up against.
It should be getting better. How come it's not getting any better?
The answer lies outside of the legal framework, I'm afraid. It lies with the evolution of our country in the direction of what some people call neoliberalism, which basically strips government of its power to do good things for people. That governing philosophy so gutted the American middle class that it exacerbated all of our inequalities. And so there are excellent things about our constitutional framework and about the United States that I, and I'm sure you, want to preserve. We want to extend them. We want to protect them from attempts by Trump and his cronies and his movement to repeal them. That's where we are, and it's a fight of our lifetime.
So the fight never ended.
The fight never ended, and in fact, it never ends.
Lawyer and retired judge Bill Blum. But historian Robert O. Paxson says despite some resemblance, Trump's government is less like that of the traditional fascists of the last century and more a government of the super rich, masquerading as populism. But he says fascist movements of the past do share certain similarities with the present.
All of them are perceived and base their legitimacy upon a promise to revive a humiliated country. A country that has been defeated, a country that has been become ungovernable, that has become economically unviable. For whatever reason, a country is down and out and in a way that makes people feel humiliated. And here comes somebody or a movement that says, we can make you great again.
Okay.
There's this element of emergency measures. You can make you great again, and we will not be bound by any kind of respect for law or tradition or custom or principle, because the only thing that matters is rebuilding the country, and we'll do anything it takes.
I see. So, and it seems that there seems to be some between fascism at least as practiced in Hitler's Germany, it was socialistic. It was Keynesian, if not socialistic. They spent a lot of money to employ people that you wouldn't really see in a modern government today as being associated with. The conservatives today are more associated with spending less money and less taxation, not spending more money and giving it off to the poor. It seems a big distinction between modern-day conservatives and fascism of that period.
Yes, it's never right to equate conservatives with fascists. The conservatives in Italy and the conservatives in Germany brought the fascists in thinking they could manipulate them and use them, but they were never identical. The fascists always had contempt for these upper class nobles and rich businessmen and so forth, whom they thought lacked energy and vigor. The conservatives were always a little frightened of these lower class militants in their brown shirts or their black shirts, who were the lifeblood of the new state. But together, they knew they could defeat communism, and so they put up with each other.
I see.
It was an uncomfortable alliance. They're never identical, and I think that you've put your finger on something. The fascists were not, well, the name of the Nazi Party, the full name of the Nazi Party is the National Socialist German Workers' Party. It was anti-communist and it defended property, but it also maintained a welfare state and took care of its working class as long as it wasn't Jewish, communist, gay, or whatever, the enemies.
Yeah, and let's jump over. Can it the question that was raised by Sinclair Lewis? It can't happen here. Can it happen? People would say it can't happen here in the in 1930s, 1940s America. After and America is United States of America, a democratic country with plenty of problems. Its own stratified society, its own denial of its own stratification at times. Yet a country that made that was obviously disgusted by what, you know, the soldiers came back from Germany and they were disgusted by what they saw. Obviously, post-World War II America, with all its problems, its nuclear bombs and everything else, the American people seemed to hold a true disgust for what fascism had wrought in Europe and considered it a great thing to have helped defeat that. Yet many people have said, well, it can happen here. And can it happen here?
I think you're right that in 1945, and not only in America but in Europe, fascism had been humiliated. Mussolini had been strung up, his body, his corpse had been strung up by his heels in a filling station in the suburbs of Milan. Hitler had committed suicide in his bunker. His servants had tried to burn his body. They were physically and morally humiliated, and for about a generation, it was simply unthinkable that anyone in Europe or America could imagine this kind of political behavior. But that's worn off. It's beginning in the 70s, after 30 years of brilliant reconstruction in Europe and 30 years of prosperity in America, things turned difficult in the 70s. The oil shocks were a part of it. The arrival of immigrants were a part of it. And you begin to have a language of decline, a language of things, that things aren't going well. And Mr. Trump, of course, was very brilliant at arguing that America had been in decline for the last 8 years or more, which was, I think, an entirely artificial construction. But there were enough people who weren't doing so well and enough people who didn't like a black president and various other measures of not doing well, that message rang a bell with a lot of people.
Right. How many Jews do you think lived in Germany? And people who don't know say 10, 15, 20% sometimes, and it turns out it was 0.5%.
Yes, and going down.
Yeah.
Going down.
Right. And so all of that over 0.5%. Now you come to the United States where the base of support for fascism, I guess, conservative, lower, middle-income white men, they can't get more than 40% of the vote, and that's if they try really hard, and it's going down. And people of African-American descent in this country are, 15, 20%. You add immigrants and Chicanos and everything, you're talking 25, 30% of the country. It's not going to be so easy to put these people under the same kind of controls that Germany did to the Jews, for example.
No, I certainly agree with that. The national emergency was nothing, and the national difficulties were nothing like as great as Trump proclaimed. He didn't, after all, get a majority of the vote. So I don't think he has the thing in his hand at all, but he has nevertheless used that kind of appeal.
Many people do say he's a fascist and use him a definition of fascism that includes things he's done. I noticed that you weren't so quick to say he was a fascist.
He's certainly a populist. He's a demagogue, a very successful demagogue so far. I think that I don't know how long he can pull that off when he has serious governing to do. But nevertheless, he has dictatorial propensities. He is personally an autocratic person, used to running a business where he can hire and fire people, and he thinks he could do that same kind of thing. There are certainly things that sound like fascism, the language of decline, the notion that you set law aside, you ignore law because you're going to fix it and by emergency measures, and you're not going to be too careful about the means, blaming the enemies, all those things resemble fascism. There are other things about Trump that are quite different, and you've already put your finger on one of them, and that's the thing, that the aspect of business policy. What's really going on here is that Trump and the Republican Party have formed this unholy alliance, which is devoted toward dismantling the legislation that protects the environment and protects working people. And that's not what fascism was about. Fascism was totally reprehensible, but they looked after the environment and they provided a certain basic degree of welfare for the nationals among their working class. This is not fascism. This is oligarchy or plutocracy.
Historian Robert O. Paxton is author of numerous books, including The Anatomy of Fascism and The Five Stages of Fascism. And that's some of the news for Friday, August 14th, 2020. The news is produced by Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI News from New York, I'm Paul DiRienzo. Thanks for listening.